Hello and welcome to this episode of the Maryland Risk Management Education Podcast. My name is Paul Gehringer and I'm the Extension Legal Specialist here in the Department of Ag and Resource Economics at the University of Maryland. And today on the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about supply chain issues during COVID-19 with Dr. Bailey Norwood. Dr. Norwood is, and let me bring this up here so I get it correctly, he's a professor and holds the Barry Pollard MD and PNK Equipment Professorship in Agribusiness at Oklahoma State in their Ag Econ department. And he has recently started teaching a class on supply chain management, and I thought it would be a good idea to have him on the podcast. Had him as a professor back in my days at Oklahoma State, so take a listen to our conversation. So Bailey, thank you for coming on today and talking to us a little bit about supply chain management. I was going to have you just sort of introduce yourself first and tell us a little bit about what you do at Oklahoma State.
Yes, well, I'm Bailey Norwood. I'm a professor at the Department of Ag Econ at Oklahoma State. Been here since 2003. And I do research in a number of areas, mostly consumer preference kind of research. I'm starting some things in research and supply chain management. And I teach several undergrad courses. I'm kind of known as the person who likes to develop new courses. And so all three courses I teach are courses that didn't exist before I came here. One is called Researching Consumer Food Preferences, where we do focus groups, taste tests, that kind of thing. Another one is a Farm to Fork class. It's kind of an ag literacy course. And then the newest one is a supply chain management course. So it's called Quantitative Supply Chain Management in Agribusiness, because you got to put all those other words there to make it sound different from the supply chain management they teach in the business college.
And you're probably teaching them the exact same thing.
Some of us say it is more quantitative than what they do. Ag economists like the numbers, but it is a basic supply chain management course.
So, and the only reason I know you do this is because I listened to Peel's podcast that he does, and you talked about this. So, and I kind of wanted to get into this. What got you interested in doing supply chain management as a course for undergrads or grad students? I couldn't remember which one it was for.
Yeah, well, one day we may take it to the grad students. You know, to start with, I wasn't really interested in supply chain management. I just thought our department needed to do it. You know, a department always has to update its curriculum, stay with the times, and I've never been really kind of a agribusiness person. And I started noticing that the word supply chain was being used everywhere in the business world except our department. And it just kind of felt like we were too old fashioned. So, and also at the same time, our board of advisory board had been suggesting for several years that we develop a supply chain management course. Because, you know, they're hearing the word supply chain everywhere and they're not seeing it in the curriculum. And so it was basically me and the department head, Mike Woods. We decided we really needed to do this. And even though I was probably one of the last people in the department who would be doing supply chain management, I was the person who'd be most interested in developing new curriculum, new stuff. And I thought it was more important than most other faculty. And so he said, would you do it? And I said, yes. And so I had to learn what supply chain management was. And, you know, I actually took a couple courses at MIT. MIT has some really nice supply chain management courses. They have this, they call it a micro master's program. And there's a collection of like four or five short but pretty challenging courses that you can take online. And that kind of told me what supply chain management was. Obviously, read a good deal about it, and I was surprised to find that a lot of the material in supply chain management is very similar to what we teach anyway. You know, some of the concepts are very similar, it's just different words and different applications. And the more I got into it, the more I thought it's something we should be teaching. We should have done this, you know, 10 years ago, and I actually developed quite a liking for it. So, you know, so much that revising a textbook I wrote, you know, about a little over 10 years ago called Ag Marketing Price Analysis. And in the revision, it's got two whole chapters in supply chain management in it now.
Wow. And that will, is that probably one of the first books that has supply chain management for ag included in it, or?
You know, it might be, it certainly has, you'll certainly see the words in other books, but they'll probably tend to approach it more from a kind of management perspective about just passing information up and down, like labeling, like beef traceability, that kind of thing. But supply chain management is so much more than that. For instance, there's a whole section on inventory management models that uses a lot of the calculus and optimization models that you did when you were an undergrad here. Mm-hmm. You know, you would, if you remembered anything from your undergrad, and I showed you some of the stuff, it would look very familiar.
And I took one supply chain management course when I was in grad school. I won't get into why I had to take it. It was to make up for another course.
Really?
And
where's this at? In
Arkansas.
Okay.
And it was taught in the MBA program they had in the business school.
Okay.
And it was, you had to show up every one Saturday a month and do weekly online stuff. But it was a lot of linear programming is what I remember.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, and in my class, it's about a third programming. But, you know, there's the marketing department here at OSU has a supply chain management, and there's no programming.
Wow. So
there's tons of different ways you can teach it. Yeah. And the MSIS department, I'm sorry, the industrial engineering department here has a supply chain management course. And if I'm remembering right, it doesn't have any program either, and it's mostly case studies.
Wow. That's very diverse.
Yeah, it really is. You know, and that's partly because supply chain management is just like a new vocabulary to things that always existed before and can be applied to almost everything. And, you know, I think the most important thing, and all my students, they know this by heart now, I tell them the most important thing about supply chain management is just using the word supply chain. You know, just whenever you can, and you know, that sounds a bit cynical, but if you listen to business people, read the news, that's how it is. And if you're not using the word supply chain, and if you don't use it right and know how to use it, it kind of makes you seem like you're out of the loop, like you're not with the world as it exists at the time.
So it's trying to fit in with the cool kids, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, sometimes I'll go in a class and I'll say, kids, what's the most important thing about supply chain management? They'll all come in saying the term supply chain, you know.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah.
So the other, get my thought here. The thing I want to talk to you today about was sort of how did COVID-19, from what you've seen, impact the ag supply chain, you know, for the products we buy in the supermarket or even getting it to the processor end.
Right. So I've seen a couple different things. One, and I think we've all learned a good bit about how supply chains in the real world work. One is that there's difference, like you can start at the farm with a particular commodity, let's say milk, and there are very different chains for sending, processing that milk and sending it to different consumers. So like there's one supply chain that processes and takes the milk to the grocery store. And then there's a whole different supply chain that processes and puts the milk in little cartons and takes them to schools and cafeterias. And one thing we've learned is those supply chains are quite separate. They haven't had to, they've been working independently for, you know, probably decades now. And so when it happened that schools shut down, different institutions shuts down, and so that normal market for, say, milk at schools was shut off, this whole supply chain that was specialized in delivering milk to, say, the schools, they no longer had that market. And it And it wasn't easy for him to just switch all over that milk to take it to the grocery store. And so, you know, they ended up dumping lots of milk and the price of milk went down. And you saw this with a lot of different things, like certain vegetables, like people ended up having to just get rid of a bunch of potatoes. I think potatoes was another big one. And, you know, in one sense, it just, it kind of seems strange that if you have all this milk and you know there's probably going to be an increase in demand at the grocery stores because that's the only place where people get that, you'd be able to develop a relationship with that other supply chain and take milk there. But that's not what happened, which means it's actually quite difficult for those supply chains to change and work together with each other. And I think that's there's a number of reasons. One is that these different supply chains are just so specialized. You know, they're brutally efficient. Whenever you're brutally efficient, you're very specialized. Machines can't just be used to put milk in milk gallon containers instead of small milk cartons. But also the, you know, the people relationships. You know, a supply chain, say, let's take the supply chain that takes milk to the grocery stores. All those different firms in a supply chain, from the people who pasteurize the milk to the people who package it to deliver it, they've got a whole system designed to maintain safety. They've got a particular way of keeping records. They develop personal relationships where they trust each other, and they've got long-term contracts. And so that thing's kind of set in stone. And it's, and you know, if you've got someone new coming in who does things a different way, it's a really big hassle to say, okay, here's how we're going to change how you're doing it. Let's develop new contracts. Let's look into these people. Do they pay their bills? It's actually a big deal. Now, if this change was permanent, if we knew there was going to be no more school system anymore, they'd find a way to work together. But I think they're rightfully seeing this as a temporary problem. And so they're just, the fixed cost of adjusting your supply chain, they made the calculation that that fixed cost is not high enough for us to find another outlet for our meal. So it makes sense to just dump it. And so that's one thing we saw. I think another thing we learned, and I picked up this, so to help me understand what supply chain management is, I'm a member of the Association, American Association for Supply Chain Management. And so, and I attend a number of their webinars. And so I was going to a number of webinars, seeing what the supply chain professionals were saying to actual businesses. And it became quite clear from that a lot of companies really didn't understand their supply chain, meaning they knew who they bought inputs from, but they didn't know who those input suppliers got their products from. And so they didn't know, so they had to ask themselves, okay, our input suppliers, do they get their stuff from China? Such that if there's a shutdown in China, is that going to impact me? They really didn't know their supply chain that well, so it was really hard for them to be able to predict what kind of shortages they were going to be up against.
Well, so you said they're highly specialized, and why would you get down to that level of detail if you're highly specialized?
Yeah, and you know, you do want to know your supply chain somewhat, but you don't want or need to know everything about it. You know, if you have an input supplier and they supply this one particular input and it's always high quality, it always comes on time, mm-hmm. it's always a good price, there's just, and you're, as a business, you're overworked as it is, it's just not worth it to look into those things. But, you know, one thing I think companies are learning is that they're gonna start doing different type of vulnerability analysis where they're saying, okay, we really can't know our supply chain that well, and supply chains may change fast enough that information will be useless. So we need to now look at our inputs and say, which of these is most vulnerable to a disruption? And then whatever those most vulnerable are, you just keep more of those in inventory. And so we started, you know, for the last 30 years, businesses have been going to this like just-in-time management strategy or lean management, which for the most part means you want to keep as little inventories as possible. But that can obviously cause you problems when there's a disruption in those inputs and you have no inventories. And what studies are finding is that the inputs that are most important to keeping in high inventory are not necessarily the inputs you spend most of your money on, and they're not the inputs that you would intuitively think are the most important. They're the little things that are highly specialized that you need, but you don't spend that much money on. So let me give an example. Suppose we're thinking of a car, and okay. Suppose you build a car and, you know, you rely on certain input providers for a lot of different things. You know, tires, that's obviously very important. Different types of metal and fiberglass windows. You probably spend tons of money on those things. But if you're already spending tons of money on those things, your input suppliers probably already consider you a higher priority. And they're probably going to have high inventories of what they have to make sure you get what you need. But what if you, but consider like this little knob that goes on your radio. You know, all the radios and cars are very specific. You can't take a radio out of a Ford and put it in a Dodge. Mm-hmm. And take this little knob. And it only comes from one supplier because they make the exact knob that you need. And you spend, because it's one little knob per car, you spend very, very little money on that. So little that you often forget who this company is. Well, if there's a shutdown in that company, you can build your whole car except for that one little knob. And that one little thing is holding you back. And that's probably the thing you need to make sure you have high inventories in.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, once you think, and you know, this was from a study. It was actually a study of a big study they did at the Ford Motor Company. And that's the kind of thing they found. And so what companies are learning is that they have to, when you want to make sure you protect your company from disruptions, you can't protect yourself against everything. So you have to prioritize and you have to say, okay, which of these inputs do we really need to focus on?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So going into the next question is sort of, and you probably have already answered this earlier, but how did we see food companies react to all this disruptions? You've kind of hit upon that, but is there anything else you kind of want to add to that? Or,
well, I would just add that I think, in my opinion, one thing we've seen, the one sector of America that really came through COVID and did an excellent job is the food corporations. You know, a lot of our government agencies didn't do as well as we expected them to do, but there was very little food shortages. You know, obviously there was sometimes. And I did a survey on this, and very few people said that they went to the store and couldn't find an item that they normally buy. You know, there was some disruption. You know, there was the whole toilet paper thing. There was some few things. But for the most part, the food was there at basically the same prices. You know, there were some anomalies. Every now and then, the price of a steak at a store would be really high. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, when you went to the store, the meat was there at basically the same price.
Yeah. I had concerns early on that plants would get shut down, so I bought some extra chicken and put it in my freezer. And yeah. I've gone through it slowly, but I never really needed it because I could always find chicken. I could always find steak.
And, you know, there was a run on – there was a time when you couldn't buy – vegetable seeds. There was a run on vegetable seeds because people thought they were going to have to raise their own garden to be able to provide their own food.
Oh, yeah, and we had the run-on flour early on, too, that took a while to catch up from.
Yeah, because and that was and yeast, because, you know, people didn't have anything to do at home, and all of a sudden they got in bread making became a hobby. But, you know, for the most part, you know, the food, you know, for, hey, whatever you say about the industrial food system that is dominated by very large interconnected corporations, they came through, the food was delivered at basically the same low prices.
And I said, even small producers here that sold at farmers markets figured out quickly how to get online, set up a store, and get product out that way as well. They it may have taken them a couple of weeks or a month, but they got product out.
Right. So, yeah, I suppose it's mainly the service industry, the restaurants that were really hurt.
Yeah.
And they tried to adapt. You know, a lot of our stores here, a lot of our restaurants here, they started doing specials and carry out. There's a local restaurant here that started working with the coffee house where they took orders in advance and prepared meals in advance and had them where you could go to the coffee shop there, pick it up. But, you know, for the most part, they suffered because you couldn't go out and eat.
Yeah. A number have done meal kits now. They've taken the Blue Apron, and I forget the other company's names, but they've taken that model and just put meal kits together for you.
Right, right.
And the chef tells you how to cook it, so you can attempt to cook yourself a high-quality meal.
Yeah. And, you know, the beer store here, so we have a new brewer. We have a microbrewery here that we didn't when you were here, Iron Monk, and we're very proud of it. And, you know, in some way, so you couldn't go to the bar and drink there, but you could go and buy beer there and take it home. But what they started doing, they started, usually they would do a new small batch of a specialized beer once a week. For a while, they started doing it every 2 weeks, and they were running out faster than ever before.
Huh.
And, you know, I think people really missed them. They wanted to support them. And so whenever they came out with something new, people went there and they bought it.
That wasn't just you and Peel buying up all the beer they had at that point.
We were certainly part of it. But no, it wasn't just, I went there one or two times and they had already run out of the small batch.
Wow. That's what I say. People really took advantage of small businesses and tried to keep the, especially the local stuff that they liked during this, it seemed like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So any other changes we can expect out of how food gets to us because of this pandemic? Or I think we kind of hit upon some of the major changes.
Yeah. You know, I think it mainly depends on our predictions of how long this will go on and whether it's going to happen again, whether it's a temporary thing or whether this is normal life. You know, let's say if in 6 months we're just getting rid of COVID and now another virus comes out that's going to be similar. Well, then things will start to maybe kind of feel like, well, this is normal life now, and just going to restaurants just isn't a thing you do near as much. And so then you'd expect many more restaurants to go out of business. And like you're saying, maybe more of those meal packs being used, grocery stores finding different ways to get food to people. But if it's just temporary and we give these businesses enough help to just get them through the bad spell, then you might expect things to go back to normal. You know, I'm sure some things will change. You know, I can tell you one thing that will change for me is that before COVID, I never used those restaurant apps. You know, I never bought through apps. But now I've got the Chick-fil-A app, I've got the Chili's app, and the Sonic app. And lately, I've gotten so used to it and I like it, I've only been going to those restaurants. Same. And so it's Pizza Hut too. And so it has definitely changed kind of which restaurants I go to and how I order. And so we would expect some changes in that regard.
Same. I use those apps in DoorDash and a few others just to make sure the food's available when I get there and I don't have to wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
I realized I didn't like lines ever in my life, and this is the best way to beat a line. I was like,
I know. I know. You know, at Chili's, I'll even get the takeout and then go into the restaurant at the bar and eat it there. You know, I don't, that way it's, I get it as soon as I get there. I can order before I go. But, of course, you know, half the time I'm also ordering while I'm driving, so maybe there's going to be more wrecks because of this.
That's true. I try to make sure I'm sitting in a parking lot when I do it. I try not to touch my phone because the fine here is too high to touch my phone while I'm driving. So. So anything else you want to add in on supply chains and –
Well, you know, I guess one thing, if people are kind of hearing about these issues for the first time, you remember when we were initially talking about how there was like one supply chain for like giving milk to institutions like schools and another one for sending milk to the grocery stores. Well, from my understanding, that is a big factor in what happened with the toilet paper shortage. There was a really good article from someone on Medium where they explained this. Where, and I never really noticed this before, but if you use the bathroom at work, the toilet paper is quite different from the toilet paper at home. Your university is spending less on toilet paper. It's not high quality. And so those are two different supply chains. And all of a sudden, when people aren't using the bathroom at the workplace, but they're using it at home, the demand for workplace toilet paper goes down. But you can't just take these that's supply chain supplies institutions and send it to the grocery store. And then it did seem like there was a quasi run on toilet paper for a while. So you had a bit of a shortage such that, you know, I asked this in a survey question. I can look it up if you want me to, but how many people, I'll tell you what, I'll try to look it up while I'm talking.
Okay.
I'll even give you an example. I was talking to my mother about toilet. So we didn't have a toilet paper shortage here, but my mother, who lives in Wilmington, North Carolina, told me there was a shortage there, and that, I mean, like a pretty big shortage, and it was such a big shortage that she actually took two rolls of toilet paper and hid them in the house for the rest of her family. Okay, so I did a survey of over 1,000 Americans in March of 2020, and I said, since the beginning of March 2020, has your household run out of toilet paper because you were unable to purchase any? And 24% of people said yes.
Oh, wow. That's not that many. So there's a website called, at the start of this, called howmuchtoiletpaperdoyouneed.com or something like that, and you could put your supply in, how many people lived in your house, and it would tell you. And I had enough, just one person living alone for 150 days, and I did not have that much toilet paper.
Right, well.
So well, I was like, I don't need to hoard this stuff. It was very helpful.
Well, that is, you know, that is when, that's one use of vegetables. That's one reason to keep vegetables on hand in the house if you ever run out of toilet paper. It is the one use for it.
Yeah.
And vegetables are edible if you add original ranch dressing.
True.
But otherwise, I agree with Jim Gaffigan. There's really no use in it.
Oh, well. Well,
this turned anti-veggie mighty quick, didn't it? This turned anti-veggie really quick. I don't know where that came from.
It really did. I was not expecting it to go down that route, but that's pretty good. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast today and talk about your new interest in supply chain management.
If you have any questions for Bailey, I put his contact info down in the show notes so you can get in touch with him, his email specifically. If you have any other thoughts on things we should be covering on the podcast, please let me know. Thank you again for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.